Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. And today's episode focuses on genocide studies. My name is Yakir Englander, your host, and today we will speak on the book Testimonies of Resistance, published in 2019. The Sonderkommando, the special squad of enslaved Jews laborers who were forced to work in the gas chambers and crematoria of Auschwitz-Birkenau, comprised one of the most fascinating and troubling topics within Holocaust history. In this dialogue, Professor Dominique Williams will help us to understand that who are these Sonderkommando and how we can learn about them. We will focus on the cruelty of the Nazis to demand from Jews to do this role and also about the complexity of the role itself. We will think together about the testimonials of the few survivors who survive from these units of Holocaust, but also on the hiding writings and art some of them hide and left for us, and much more. Professor Dominique Williams edited this volume of articles together with Professor Nicholas Cher. Together, they also co-authored two more books on the same subject, Matters of Testimony and the Auschwitz Sonderkommando. Professor Williams is senior lecturer in Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Northumbria University.
So welcome, Dominique. And my first question is, can you share with our audience what have made you to choose to dedicate your research to the question of the Sonderkommando?
Well, I can blame it all on Nicholas Cher. My background is in, I guess, initially in literature. I did a PhD, which was a literature PhD. It was at the Center for Jewish Studies at the University of Leeds, but it was about English literature, early 20th century. Nick Cher, who also studied at Leeds, came to me after we'd finished our PhDs and said, you know, there's a topic that I'm interested in doing more research on. I'd done a little bit on it before, which was the writings of the Auschwitz Sonderkommando, the scrolls of Auschwitz. And he said, you know, would you be interested in working on this with me? And my initial thought was, well, I'm not really sure that I do want to. It's very, very difficult material, right? I'd done some work in my master's, my MA on the Holocaust, and thought, I'm not sure if this is for me. But in the end, he persuaded me that this was something would be worthwhile for us to work on together. So we co-authored a book about the writings of the Sonderkommando, Matters of Testimony, which Berghahn Books also published. And then following up on that, we found that there were still questions that we wanted to ask, that we thought needed to be investigated. And so that's meant that we've carried on publishing about it. The Auschwitz Sonderkommando, which we published with Palgrave Macmillan, is about post-war testimony from the Sonderkommando. And then Testimonies of Resistance, this recent edited collection, has got a group of scholars together, an international set of scholars together to write about some of the questions that, you know, we felt still needed to be discussed.
And can you share with us, Dominique, about the title? You called it Testimonies of Resistance. Can you share with us a little bit about the term, like, why did you choose resistance?
Well, I think resistance is really important when we're thinking about the Sonderkommando for a number of reasons, but I guess we could flag up two. So one is, firstly, that it's an important way in which people have thought about them. Okay, it's part of their image. It's not the only image of the Sonderkommando, but it's one image of them, which is to say that they are famous for the uprising that happened in October 1944 in Auschwitz-Birkenau. And it's one of the things that is known about them. And the other thing, and this is partly the reason why we've called it Testimonies of Resistance, is that something that they're much less well known for is writing these testimonies, writing the scrolls of Auschwitz, the documents that they buried in the grounds of the crematoria, describing what they'd seen, what they felt about, what they were co-opted into being part of, this process of mass murder. And those testimonies are also a form of resistance. And it's worth bearing in mind also that the testimony doesn't only take written form. There are also photographs, of course, and those are quite famous as well. But those are photographs that were taken by one member of the Sonderkommando, helped by another set of people from the Sonderkommando, that were testifying to that process of mass murder, and that were also, in doing that, attempting to resist it.
Thank you. So I would love if we can start from beginning, which is, Dominique, can you help us to understand better what exactly is a Sonderkommando? When you work on this subject, who are part of this group? And also, in which camps do we speak about? What will be the definition of a camp that we speak about Sonderkommando? And maybe the last question is, when we start using this term?
Right, okay. So, there are different ways to use the term Sonderkommando. Firstly, I mean, in German, it just means something like special squad. So it doesn't mean anything particular. And that's deliberately euphemistic, as a lot of these kind of terms are. I mean, okay, the process of of murdering gas chambers is Sonderbehandlung, special treatment. The final solution, okay, is also a euphemism as well. And so it's a term that was used for more than one group. And that includes groups of perpetrators as well. So it doesn't have one fixed set definition. But what it's often used for is to describe groups of prisoners in a number of different camps, extermination sites, so places like Treblinka, Sobibor, Auschwitz-Birkenau, prisoners who were forced to assist in some way with the process of murder. Now, in some of those other camps, places like Treblinka, Sobibor, those terms are used by historians and people about them, but are not always completely contemporaneous. They weren't used at the time. Whereas as far as Auschwitz-Birkenau is concerned, the group were called the Sonderkommando as they were part of the Sonderkommando. So you see in their testimonies, for example, they describe themselves and they write down this word, Sonderkommando. So it's used in different ways. And the way that we've decided to define the term for this collection, okay, it's not to say it's the only way that it could be done, but for this collection, we decided to define the term by that group in Auschwitz-Birkenau. And it's that group that we've concentrated on. And we say a little bit in the introduction as to why that is, because there are certain things that are particularly different about them. There's a larger number of survivors. There's a large amount of testimony about them. And also, actually, I would say they're a group that are more notorious in a lot of ways, because they were part of a much larger camp complex and so were witnessed by other prisoners. And so there were stories and thoughts about them from other prisoners within Birkenau. at the time. I mean, okay, rumors circulated around the camp. Strange representations of them were happening even while the camp was in operation. So we're looking at that particular group, and the Sonderkommando there was a group that was formed and changed a little bit as Auschwitz-Birkenau developed, but in its sort of, well, I suppose what you might call its classic formation, was the group that were in Birkenau and that worked in the crematoria of Birkenau. There was a group that worked in Auschwitz I in the crematorium that's there. Philipp Müller famously worked there for a short while, and then after working elsewhere for a while, transferred to the crematorium Birkenau. But the group of which the vast majority of survivors come from, I mean, it's still a small number of survivors, but in relative to
because of the system, Dominique, because of the system that every few months the Nazis will kill them.
Right. So this is one of the interesting things that we've dealt with this image of the Sonderkommando. Now, of course, it is absolutely true that the Sonderkommando were subject to murder, and squads were, the numbers were taken down or increased as they were found to be useful. But there does not seem actually to have been this systematic replacement of them every 3 or 4 months that you hear in some of the stories about them. I mean, I suppose most famously, there's the doctor who was stationed in the crematorium, Miklos Nisli, writes in his testimony, yes, they were replaced en masse every 3 or 4 months. But that doesn't seem to have been quite the case. If you look, for example, at Gideon Greif's book, where he's interviewed members of the Sonderkommando who survived, a lot of them survived for much longer than 3 or 4 months. If you look at the group of prisoners that we concentrated on, where we looked at testimony that they'd written, again, there are a number of them who, only one of those who wrote the writing survived. Of the writings that have been found, only one of them himself survived, but all of the others survived for longer than just 3 or 4 months. So, for example, Zalman Gradovsky, Zalman Leventhal, Leib Langfuss, all seem to have survived until came to Auschwitz-Birkenau in 1942, December 1942, and all survived until late 1944. Gradovsky seems to have died in the uprising in October 44. Leventhal and Langfuss seem to have been killed when there was another purge of the Sonderkommando in November 1944. So there are prisoners who lasted for much longer than this, which in the end is a kind of legend, right, of just this 3 or 4 months.
Thank you. So, Dominique, can you share with us a little bit about the way how a person become part of the Sonderkommando? Is it something that, and I'm interested mostly from the moment where people know about the Sonderkommando, but they still are or chosen or forced to be chosen to join this group. And I also wonder if it's like one way, like you can join to the Sonderkommando, but then you stay there, or is that more fluid that you can come back and leave this unit?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good question. Is there one way to join? And I don't think that there is. So there are different accounts from different people as to how it happened. The most common experience seems to have been, and this again is at the point when the crematorium Birkenau are in operation. The most common way seems to have been that people who are new arrivals at the camp, possibly having spent a week or so in quarantine, were chosen immediately after that and put to work straight away. So, and the logic of that seems to have been, and some of them write about it this way, that it was something that took them by complete surprise. They were taken to somewhere where they had to deal with emptying a gas chamber, a set of dead bodies, the shock, the horror of dealing, of confronting that sight, quelled any sense of resistance, was sort of too much for them really to comprehend at that point. They're then forced under beating and whips, Leventhal writes about this, to clear those bodies. And it's only after they've carried out this work, in a sense, in inverted commas, a lot of them afterwards said, you know, work is not the word for this, but only after they carried out this work that they were in a position to be able to process anything like what had happened to them. So that certainly seems to be the case for most of the people who are the people who wrote the manuscripts, the scrolls of Auschwitz, that they were recruited very soon after arrival. But it's not necessarily true for every single member of the Sonderkommando. And the question that you're asking about the fluidity, again, it would seem that once it had taken its, once the camp regime had worked out what form they wanted this squad to take, it was very, very rare for someone in the Sonderkommando to be able to come out of it. Everybody who was in. And the only way out would be by being killed or by dying.
And the reason is that the Nazis didn't want them to bring right. the witness, the stories.
Right. Right. So they did not want people who were witnesses to mass murder, witnesses to genocide. I mean, they were eyewitnesses to many, many thousands of deaths. Yeah. They did not want them to be able to bear witness to what it is that they'd seen. In the earlier forms, there are people who seem to have moved in and out of the squads, and that actually is true for Philip Müller, for example, that he was in the squad in Auschwitz 1 and then moved out, said he was stationed in Buna, Auschwitz 3 for a short while, and then went back into the Sonderkommando after that. But that, I think, is in its early stage as well, when the process is still being worked out, improvised by the Germans, by the camp regime. By the time most of the people who were survivors, most of the people who wrote the manuscripts were within the squad. They were recruited very soon after arrival and had no way out other than their own deaths.
Yeah, thank you. One of the chapters, actually it's the first chapter, which is fascinated by Professor Pollock, but it's a question that's also coming all during the book, is a question of cruelty. And we have here maybe three areas of cruelty and questions of violence. One is, of course, the violence by the Nazis. To the victims and to the Sonderkommando. There are questions of ethics about the work of the Sonderkommando. And of course, the third spherical is the other prisoners in these camps and how they received and how they think about the Sonderkommando. Can you explain us a little bit more about this complex question of cruelty and violence?
Yes, I mean, I think Griselda Pollock's essay is a really powerful and fascinating explanation of this question. So, I mean, as I said when talking about the recruitment of the Sonderkommando and as what you see in some of their writings, there is violence, direct physical violence carried out by German guards, SS guards, to members of the Sonderkommando in order to keep them at their work, but it's not something that was used with the same kind of regularity or extremity in most cases as you saw in the rest of the camp, because these were people who they wanted to keep fit and well and carrying out a process that, as far as they were concerned, a murderous process, but a process that the Germans saw as useful. Okay, they had a useful function. So there is physical violence. It's not to say that there was none that was carried out against members of the Sonderkommando by SS guards. But, and I think Pollock brings this out really well in the essay, there is another kind of violence that's being done to them, which is the cruelty of being forced to violate their own ethical precepts, violate their own religious beliefs in disposing of the dead, in making sure that there is no trace left of them. And I think Pollock talks very powerfully and at length at this idea of being forced to burn bodies was something that caused them particular kind of horror and particular pain. And that, I think, is interesting also in that it seems to have also been something that other prisoners were particularly horrified by. So there's a memoir by Krystyna Przywulska, I Survived Auschwitz, where she talks about talking to a member of the Sonderkommando. And the thing that she says, she sees him initially as basically subhuman. And the thing that she says, and the reason why she finds him beyond the kind of moral pale, is you burn bodies. Okay, so it's not that she's saying, right, you're helping people to be murdered, right? Because there was a function that the Sonderkommando partly had, just they were allowed or they were made to stand in the undressing room while victims were undressing. They weren't allowed to talk to the people there, but the SS regime essentially found that that was a way to keep people as they were undressing calmer, right? So they are, in some sense, made complicit in keeping people calm and more easy to murder. But what Krystyna Przywulska finds particularly horrific about what they're doing is what they're doing to bodies, that they're burning them. So in a sense, I think I would say, and I don't think this is what Dr. Pollock herself explores, but I think what you see there is a kind of violence that is done to the Sonderkommando by making them kind of moral outcasts in the eyes of other prisoners. So it's something that's a violence that's done, that's internalized on themselves. They feel, again, in some of the writings you see, they feel a kind of guilt or disgust at themselves at times, but they also are provoking that in other prisoners as well. So it's a very difficult position that they're in. It's a very difficult question to assess their own judgment of themselves, prisoners' judgments of themselves, and how it is that we're supposed to be judging or not judging them retrospectively as scholars or as people thinking back to the Holocaust.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I wonder if you can if we can stay a little bit about the act of burning, and I wonder if the focus is on the act of burning maybe because of two reasons, as I understand. One is that the act of burning is a place where they shift from being passive, like just helping, to doing the act of violence to the bodies. And also, secondly, because the act of burning is actually the witness for what is happening, because the prisoners in Auschwitz or in other camps maybe are not aware of the gas all the time, but the smell of the burning is a witness for the violence.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way of thinking about it, which I don't think we've actually explored as much as we probably could have done in the book. But I think that's a really, really interesting question. Yes, I mean, I think you're right that that kind of disgust that you see, for example, in Przywulska, or this self-disgust, does seem to could be said to focus on this moment precisely because it is something where you're doing something. I think that's quite plausible. And I think too, I mean, Przewalska, when she's writing about seeing this member of the Sonderkommando, she talks about him being covered in ash, and there are other people who've witnessed members of the Sonderkommando also said that, you know, they were black from the burning that they were carrying out, which also made them kind of look strange and a kind of figure of horror. So that was something that was on their bodies themselves. But exactly as you say, it's also something that becomes the signal of what's going on at the crematoria, and that everybody can see and smell. I mean, particularly smell,
right,
in the region around. I mean, and that idea that it could be a form of witness, mm-hmm, is something that members of the Sonderkommando themselves did think about. Zalman Gradovsky, in one of the texts that he wrote, talks about how the fire that's burning in the crematoria is something that the world should see, and something that the world should be drawn to. So it's a way that they were thinking about it as well, I think. So that's a very, very interesting and valid point from you.
Thank you. So the majority of the book focuses on questions of evidence and history and how we think about the Sonderkommando. And I really love the way how you divided the book to, in a way, I mean, you have four, it's divided to four parts, but the three of them is about evidence from the time of the war. Then we have the evidence of the retrospective, when we think about that and when they witness after that about what happened there. And then we have the cinema and we have literature, right? And I wonder if you can help us, because the question of history and the Holocaust is so complicated. So can you share with us a little bit more about, like, what do we find or which kind of voices we hear more during the war, and which voices we hear in the retrospective when survivors of the Sonderkommando or people who witnessing the Sonderkommando, they share?
Right. I'll answer it in this way. We'll see if it answers your question. I mean, one of the things that we were very interested in when we wrote about the Sonderkommando's manuscripts was the fact that these seemed like key pieces of testimony about the Holocaust, about the Shoah. But there seemed to be very little interest in them. Hardly anything had looked at them in any great detail. They do get mentioned. Okay, they appear in histories. But there's very little engagement with how it is that they're written. And if you look at them, it's very, very striking that they're written in this often very highly literary or would-be literary way. So one of the questions that we were asking that sort of driven us on to do these other books is to think, well, what is it that has stopped people from reading these manuscripts? And so one of the things, obviously, I think, has been this sense of horror and disgust, but also fascination, right, at this group, which has meant either that people aren't interested in it, in talking about them, or are interested, but in a way that doesn't really help them to engage with the kind of manuscripts that the Sonderkommando wrote. So I think what I'd say is, what if you're looking at what the Sonderkommando themselves write, what you see or what they're producing themselves during the time that the Birkenau is in operation, when the crematoria are in operation, is a very complex picture, one that says that there are times when they are unfeeling, numb, completely shocked and unable to process what's happening to them, but that there are other times when they are able to reflect on it and they are able to feel certain things about what's happening. And I think in the way that we would read it, certainly that's one of the things we argued in Matters of Testimony, I think one of the things that's happening is they're thinking about how they can make their readers feel what's happening or what's happened to them. And so that's much more complex set of how they think about their experiences and how they feel and feel through their experiences than I think a lot of the post-war ways of thinking of them have been. So we explore this to some degree in the introduction to the book, where we say, okay, there seem to have been shifts that have happened over time of how people have been interested, and that from a kind of sense that the Sonderkommando might stand for a general suspicion of survivors, that people only survived because they'd done something dubious, to criticism of them as being too passive. And I think this is where this idea that it's not true that they were purged that they were liquidated every 3 or 4 months is quite important, because someone like Bruno Bettelheim is able to say, well, there were 14 squads of the Sonderkommando, only one squad resisted, right? Everybody else just went to their deaths after 4 months. But that if you accept, and this seems to be what the evidence says, if you accept that that's not what the composition was like, then you have to take into account also that there's a complicated way in which they existed as the people who went along in an attempt to survive for some time also resisted at others. That then kind of, I think, changes the picture of what it is that you can say about the Sonderkommando. And I think what we also say in that introduction is that there seem to have been two moments. I mean, we identify one in the kind of mid-80s, so Shoah, Claude Lanzmann's film, and a number of other texts that came out in the mid-80s seem to take an interest in the Sonderkommando, particularly as Lanzmann is concerned as precisely as witnesses, but witnesses as he's defining it. Okay, so there's an interest in what he calls incarnation, these moments, most famously, of course, with Shoah, with Abraham Bomber, the barber, freezing while he's reenacting and cutting somebody's hair, and unable to go on talking about what had happened to him while he was in Treblinka. But also with Philip Müller as well, this moment where he reaches silence and says, right, I want to stop. I just can't go on at this point. So those kind of moments are looking at the Sonderkommando in a different way, but are not the same as I would say what you can see from the Sonderkommando's own manuscripts, because you can see there that there are more complicated and more contradictory things that are happening than I think Lanzmann teases out in his film, powerful and extraordinary as that film is. And we've seen very recently in particularly, I suppose, in Son of Saul, the film, another interest in the Sonderkommando, which seems to be partly about a willingness now to address some of the more difficult issues of the Holocaust that have been addressed at other times previously, but seem to be much more central to how people are thinking about and talking about the Holocaust now. I mean, one example of that, of course, is that Son of Saul won an Academy Award, right? It got an Oscar. Whereas if you think at the kind of Oscar-winning Holocaust films from not that much earlier than that, Schindler's List, Life is Beautiful, they were giving a much... I mean, it's unfair in some ways to call it easier, but okay, in some ways, a much easier view of the Holocaust than Son of Saul. Or perhaps we could say less difficult.
Part in the book, and there is a whole chapter about the religious life of the Sonderkommando, because as we see from the witnesses, we are learning that we have people who are religious and people who are non-religious, atheist in the same units. And I wonder if you can share with us, as the editor of the book, what you take from that, like what we can learn about the meaning of being a religious person as part of the Sonderkommando. My field is Jewish ethics and Jewish law. So there are many halakha, the Jewish law, about questions in the Holocaust. Not so many about the Sonderkommando, which is fascinating that, I mean, how many rabbis, but from what I learned from reading this fascinating book, we have there people who know the Jewish law and they have deep Jewish spirituality. And I wonder if you can sum to us What does it mean to be, for them, a religious person in the Zondere Commando?
I mean, I think I should admit, first of all, that this is not my specialism, and you're talking partly about Gideon Greif's chapter there, talking about the religious life of the Zondere Commando. So I would want to approach my answer to you here with a certain degree of caution. But I suppose we could certainly say for a start that it's important to recognize the variety of experiences within the Zondere Commando, and that there are people who are very religious and continue to be religious while they're in the Zondere Commando, just as there are other people who are not. So that's one thing. I think another thing I would say is seeing people maintain religious life also is important for us to understand, important for us in our understanding of the Zondere Commando, because some of that is simply about an attempt to maintain an everyday life, an everyday existence, okay, which, however distorted and strange and horrific it is something much more than this image that we have. And I think even a film like Son of Saul portrays it to some degree, this image that we have of them as just a set of zombies. Okay, they are people who are thinking and feeling and trying to live lives as, in some sense, as best they can. Okay, and that is part of what their religious life is about. I think also, I think Gideon Greif brings that out very well in that chapter by him. I think also what I could add is that looking at the manuscripts that the Zondere Commando wrote, one of those, one of the writers, Leib Langfuss, was someone who had rabbinic training. He was a rabbinic judge, a dayan. And certainly as we would read it, and I think someone who was better versed in the religious traditions that Langfuss is coming from, but we made a start, I hope. But as we would read it, there are certainly ways in which his religious knowledge or his cultural, religious, social background work through the way in which he's able to write about and represent and bear witness to what he had seen. So, for example, there are a set of very small anecdotes, you could almost call them, that he writes about how people behaved on the threshold of the gas chamber. And he calls that details, Einzelheiten in Yiddish. And he seems to use traditions of storytelling, and some people who survived and talked about him called him a storyteller, called him a preacher, a magid, he seems to be using traditions of storytelling in the way that he structures those stories of how people behaved. And you also see, I mean, he's clearly has interest in religious figures. He talks about different religious figures and how they behaved. And he certainly seems to feel that people who were religious behave better than people who are not. He contrasts an intellectual who seems to believe, even as he enters the gas chamber, that this, it couldn't really happen, with religious figures who are able to face up to it. But that I would say, you know, shows that it's his set of understanding has shaped how he understands what's going on. His background has shaped how he understands what he's witnessing, but also allows him to bear witness to it in a particular form that makes sense to him, and that, you know, would allow readers to make sense of as well.
Another thing that really as I was reading the book, I was thinking about the geography of the people who are in the Zondere Commando, right? We have people from Greek and people from Hungary. We have here complexity of languages. We have complexity of culture, complexity of people who come much earlier and people who only came later in 44 and later. Can you share with us about, so when we say Zondere Commando, we actually see many variety of colors from different geography places.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that that's important to remember. So as you say, there are groups who were from Poland. So a lot of the people who wrote the scrolls of Auschwitz were from Polish backgrounds, from northeast Poland or from just north of Warsaw. And they are people who were there for the longest, in that they came in late 1942. The group that preceded them, and this I think might be part of where these stories about complete liquidation come from, do seem to have almost entirely been murdered just before these Polish Jews came to Birkenau in December 42. And those were mainly from Slovakia. Philip Muller is the example here of someone who survived. There are, there's one other person who's a survivor there, as far as I'm aware, it's just the two of them. But so there's this group that are there from December 42, and then other groups come and are added to that squad as the operations in the crematoria expand. And then it's when there are moments when operations come down or are less intensive, where the squad is brought down in its numbers. But precisely because there are people who are there for quite a long time and other people are brought in, you end up with a squad that's very mixed. So Polish, exactly as you say, people who are then coming from France. A lot of those were Polish Jews. One of the people who wrote a letter, who we've now identified as Hermann Strassvogel, I guess, who was originally from Poland but had settled in France, was part of that group. David Oller, a painter who drew sketches of the crematoria, painted paintings about his experience in the Sonderkommando, was part of that group as well. And then groups from, exactly as you say, Hungary, as in 1944, in the summer of 1944, the Hungarian Jews are brought in. Hungarian Jews are also recruited into the Sonderkommando. There seem to be very few survivors from that group. So it's in some ways one of the more mysterious experiences. But we shouldn't forget also the Greek Jews, exactly as you mentioned as well. The last document from the scrolls by Marcel Nagyari the last one to be found in 1980, was by him, written in Greek. And there are other survivors of the Greek Jews of the Sonderkommando who talk often about being outcasts among the Sonderkommando because they couldn't speak Yiddish, because they couldn't therefore understand German. They were given the worst tasks. You also see the different memories of the experience, different memories of the revolt. Greek Jews will often talk about it was the Greeks who were responsible for the revolt. Polish Jews, you see in their writings, saying it was the Poles who did it. Okay, so in a sense, there's nothing unusual here. If you bring a group of people who are from different backgrounds, there will be frictions between them. And under the kind of extreme pressure that they're living, then those frictions will, of course, be worse, more deadly in some ways, more painful. But I think it's also worth bearing in mind, and although that is, I think, primarily the way that people have talked about the difference between these groups, there are ways in which alliances or friendships happened across national boundaries. So, for example, the French Jews were generally of Polish background, generally had been born in Poland. And so they spoke Polish, sometimes spoke
Polish. So they had a way to communicate. Right.
But they also spoke French. And a lot of Greek Jews, or certainly some of the Greek Jews, were educated to speak French as well. And so the French Jews were able to befriend and work with the Greeks. And there's some element of communication possible that goes between the Greek Jews, the French Jews, the Polish Jews. So, you know, that's not to say that they were all getting on, let's say. It clearly was, you know, under the horrific conditions they were living, but clearly there were frictions there and resentments there. But you do see records of friendships. There's record of friendship in Marcel Nagyeri's letter, where he talks about you do see evidence of that in Hermann Strasbourgeois's letter, the French letter, where he talks about a friendship with a Greek Jew, Leon Cohen. And you do see in the memoirs of Greek survivors. So Marcel Nagyeri, in his memoir, talks also about being friends with Hermann Strasbourgeois. So there clearly were ties that went across national boundaries that you can see.
Thank you. So my last question is it's a hard one because it's a question about ethics. So you have some chapters that are dealing with the question of the memory of the Sonderkommando. And we see the changes in the ways of memory of this unit. We have it in the museum in Auschwitz. You have a chapter about that dedicated to that. You have, of course, you just mentioned the fascinating movie that I think shake all of us who watch it, Sol San. You have the Gray Zone movie, of course. You have in Israel, there are not a lot in literature about the Sonderkommando in literature, but you have a beautiful and very sensitive short story by Savion Liebrecht, who I believe also was translated to English and to German, and where she speaks about a relationship between a father and his only child, a young woman, who come back home one day and she says, Abba, father, I'm going to get engaged. And he's so happy for her. And then when the future son-in-law is coming to the house, he just faints because he sees a Sonderkommando from the camp. And I wonder if you can help us about what is the memory that we have about the Sonderkommando as you see it? And do you feel that there need to be more change? Do we need to walk to maybe another direction with some elements of this memory?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, this is a difficult question. And I think one of the things that we're trying to explore, and actually I think probably needs to be explored some more, is the ways that the memory so far has been, let's say, at least kind of problematic. So that sense of, okay, these are people I don't want to think about, I can't bear to think about, is one element that is obviously a problem. But even the kind of interest in them takes a kind of form of a fascination that often is problematic as well. I mean, I guess, yes, I think one of the things that needs to be done, and I hope that we're trying to move towards, I think there are other people who've done work in this area, Gideon Greif, for example. I mean, I think that Andreas Killian has done work with the Sonderkommando, Aurelia Kaliski has done work with the writings of the Sonderkommando as well. But I think we need to engage with them more with the sense that they are damaged but fully rounded human beings. And that although there's one of the reasons why we're thinking about the Sonderkommando is because they seem to have been the victims of what Primo Levi calls the Nazis' most demonic crime. Okay. And to be able to understand that damage that's done to them by being forced into this moral position where they have to violate some of their most deeply held principles, there is still, I would say, too much emphasis on the question of damage. Obviously, we need to think of these as, you know, the harm that was done to them was extensive, lasting, and in some senses probably irreparable. But we need to think also about them as people who still had other human dimensions to them as well, both as they were living in the camp and as they were survivors. And I'd just say even one little detail, right, that recurs in the memory of the Zonda commander, this idea that every 3 or 4 months they were liquidated, right? That sounds like it's just a detail of facts that might be wrong or it might not be. But what I tried to do in my essay on Lev is that the gray zone, perhaps less clearly than I could have done. But what I tried to do in that was to say, well, actually, there seems to be a reason that people hold on to this idea. And it is that it makes the lives of the Zonda commando much less, in a sense, much less understandable, or much more strangely fascinating as well. Which is to say, if you are presented with the choice, okay, you can die now or you can die in 4 months' time, and to live for that extra 4 months, you have to violate all the things that you hold most dear about yourself, that seems to be presented as just a moral choice. What is my life worth? What is 4 months of my life worth? But actually, what the members of the Zonda Commando were doing, insofar as they were able ever to make choices, and of course that's difficult, particularly at the moment of recruitment when they're not fully aware of what it is that they're supposed to be doing or what's happening. But even so, at moments when they're asking the question of can I carry on with my life, actually they were looking at a situation where they didn't know. They didn't know how much longer they had to live. And so forth. So therefore, one of the things that they're asking is actually just a question about not what's 4 months of my life worth, but what can I do possibly to give myself just a chance, a small chance of surviving? And I think that, in a way, is a lot more understandable than to be saying someone was faced with a choice of, you know, you will die in 4 months, but you'll be able to live for 4 months if you do these particular things. So I think, you know, even these simple facts about the Zonda Commando are ones that I would say have a certain kind of moral weight to them. And I think it's important for us to get those facts right as well. But I think that is part of a picture where we need to be thinking about them as, you know, more than just the damage that was done to them. The damage is important, but the rest of who they are is important as well.
Dominique? Thank you so much for editing together with Nicolas Cher the book Testimonies of Resistance and for being with us here in the New Books Network.
Thank you. Thank you very much.